Chapter 2. Shadow and Iron. Spoils. The Sepulchre. Thoic and Newman pressed themselves hard against the walls, but there was no escaping the fusillade of mass reactives. Two shells struck Thoic's gorge and visor, spinning him into the path of two more. He dropped to the deck with blood arcing from his ruptured plates. Newman bent low into the storm, taking the brunt of the fire on his shoulder guards. Miraculously, every shell ricocheted from the curved plates without detonating. With a roar of hatred, Newman threw himself at the nearest Terminator. A clubbing fist of elephantine proportions picked Newman up and slammed him hard against the bulkhead. Newman's strangled cry over the vox was grating with shattered bone and wet with blood. The Terminators stepped forwards together.
"Captain Tyro," said a voice that seemed to whisper over the vox, "drop to the deck and hold on to something."
Tyro knew that voice and knew better than to argue. He released the shields and dropped his exhausted arms, throwing himself flat on the deck plates. The fire from the turrets pummeled the Terminators, halting their advance. Tactical dreadnought armor was proof against most things, but even it had its limits. A combi bolter exploded as its magazine took a hit, and the Alpha Legionnaire staggered as his arm disappeared below the elbow. The second Alpha Legion Terminator bent low and lumbered towards Tyro. High-caliber shells exploded against his armor, cracking the plates and drawing blood. Not enough to stop him, but he was hurting. The turrets targeting augurs abruptly disengaged upon registering friendlies. Tyro looked up to see the second Terminator poised to crush him beneath its giant boot. Above the emerald Hydra symbol, a fulminate bright halo of light appeared on the ceiling. Tyro knew of only one weapon that could cause that effect. Lascutter. He gripped the mesh decking hard enough to bend the steel. The Terminator looked up in time to see a 3-meter section of the ceiling blow out in a rush of detonation. Hurricane force wind rammed up through the ceiling, and Tyro saw a series of concentric holes above it, leading all the way to the void of space. Not even the immense mass of a Terminator could compete with the force of explosive decompression. The Alpha Legionnaire flew up through the ceiling like a bullet shot from a gun as he was hurled out into space. Tyro was lifted into the air and spun around by the decompressive storm. His boot slammed into the wall and he activated the magnetic clamps. He saw Newman and Thoic farther down the corridor, also mag-locked against the bulkhead. The wounded Terminator had been too far from the hole to be dragged into the void. He too was mag-locked. The sudden drop in pressure abruptly equalized, the hull breach sealed somewhere above. He fell to the deck as a dark shape dropped through the hole in the ceiling. A warrior, armed in black plate, but a black that seemed utterly non-reflective and which actively repelled light. His bulk marked him a legionary, but one who moved like no other warrior Tyro knew. The warrior vaulted towards the Terminator, kicking off the wall and triggering a compact jump pack. Blue-hot jets carried him over the Terminator's shoulder in a graceful parabola. A black-bladed gladius that reflected no light plunged down into the Terminator's weakest point, the sliver of flex seal between his gorge and the base of his helm. A squirting geyser of blood fountained from the traitor's neck as the obsidian-edged gladius severed his carotid artery. It kept pumping, even as the Terminator halted, the warrior within dead, but kept upright by his armor's weight. Nykona Sharokin of the Raven Guard landed lightly behind his victim as another figure dropped through the hole in the ceiling. He landed hard, cratering the deck plates, and Tyro saw he bore a pair of heavy breaching charges under each arm. Diffuse light from an energy field above limned his armor in pellucid blue illumination. This warrior was also armored in black, but his was the black of the Iron Hands and bore the mailed gauntlet.
"Wayland," said Tyro.
Sabic Wayland didn't answer, and moved past him to affix the breaching charges to the blast shutters securing the bridge. He slammed his palms on the activation triggers and ran back to Tyro. He picked up Ignatius Newman's shield and hunkered down behind it.
Right now would be a good time to lift that shield again, Captain Tyro.
With the fall of the bridge, the battle was won, and the stripping operation on the Zeta Morgeld went into full effect. Weapons, ammunition, spare parts, fuel, tools, and raw materials, even a pair of Stormbirds on the portside launch rails. Nothing would be wasted. The thrall crew of the Sisypheum would leave this ship a gutted hulk before casting it and its dead crew into the nuclear heart of a star. The detritus of battle had been cleared from the embarkation deck, and cargo haulers from the Sisypheum were being loaded by bulk servitors that had once served the Alpha Legion. Cadmus Tyro walked slowly along the line of bodies dumped at the edge of the embarkation deck. Stripped of their armor, the Alpha Legion corpses were a stark reminder of how thoroughly hate could dismantle flesh, even that of a transhuman.
"Us reactives account for less than half of these kills," said Tyro, pointing out the wound patterns and apocalyptic damage wrought on the bronzed, knotted flesh of the dead. "The majority are pure close-quarter kills." "It's visceral," said Vermana Cybus, spitting caustic saliva at each corpse as they passed. "Cathartic. Personal. No one else has more reason than us to hate these turncoat bastards."
Tyro couldn't argue with that. Ferus Manus, the Gorgon, their gene sire, was dead. Murdered on Istvan by a brother in a moment of unimaginable betrayal. And in his death were the seeds of madness sown. The Primarch's end had been so terrible, so shocking, it had carved an abyssal void in the Iron Tenth psyche that might never heal. Grief had almost ended their defiance in the weeks since the bloody black sands of the Urgal Depression, but that grief had long since curdled into hate. And hate was the twisted cousin of bloody retribution.
"And for sure this is all of them?" asked Tyro.
"Aye," said Cybus. "I've been through every hidden corner and secret passage of the ship myself. 20 legionaries all told.
There's only 15 here. Tarsa's taken 5 back to the Sisypheum to cut up."
"What for?"
"Where should I know? I'm not an apothecary."
"Fair enough.
But 20 warriors isn't many for a strike cruiser."
Cybus shrugged, and his bare metal limbs clattered against his armor. None of the Sisypheum's crew could match Cybus in zeal for chimeric augmentation. Even before the atrocity on Istvan, Cybus had embraced the nascent creed of self-mortification with the fervency of a zealot.
"Probably someone hit them in the years since Istvan," said Cybus. "We're not alone fighting them out here in the dark."
"Perhaps. But this didn't feel like a ship operating below strength," said Tyro,
pausing as the Alpha Legion's operational methodology struck a disquietingly familiar note.
"It's a strike cell," he said. "A single ship with a small crew flying off-grid. It's what we're doing."
Cybus nodded, accepting Tyro's logic.
"Well, you really think they were en route to Alpharis?"
Tyro sighed.
"We'll know for sure once the Kryptos finishes with the logs Wayland exploded."
"But can we trust anything he might tell us?"
"I don't know, Vermana," said Tyro. "But if it's true, there's a chance to strike back at the traitors in such a meaningful way, to hurt them as we were hurt. We need this, Vermana."
"Aye, Captain, we do. But that's for Captain Branson to decide."
Tyro nodded stiffly. Cybus was right. Despite resting in an ice-locked stasis casket, Ulrak Branthon was still the captain of the Sisypheum's warriors.
"Have you—"
"No,"
said Tyro, already regretting having told Cybus what he'd seen, or what he thought he'd seen, in Branthon's cryo-chamber.
"The captain remains as he always has. And Tarsa? What does he say?"
"Nothing,"
snapped Tyro.
"What do you expect him to say? The captain is locked in frozen stasis. Wounds do not heal within a stasis field.
No one miraculously heals mortal wounds. No one rises from death. No matter how much we would wish it.
With the wounded stabilized in the Apothecarian, Atesh Tarsa bore the honored dead down into the frozen sepulchres of the Sisypheum. His reductor gauntlet weighed heavy with the genetic legacy of 6 brothers of the Iron Hands, 6 heroes who would no longer stand against the arch traitor. The passageways this deep were crusted frost white, like a cave system within an ancient glacier. It made sound and light behave strangely. Echoes of Tarsa's footsteps travelled ahead of him, and his fractured reflection writhed in the ice. Easy to understand how rumours of spectral apparitions and phantom voices in the depths had spread through the crew, Space Marine and Legion Serf alike. Nonsense, of course, but even brains as augmented and disciplined as a legionary's were prone to pareidolia. The sterile air glittered with white flakes, and gleaming icicles hung from structural beams like glassy daggers. Tarsa passed the sepulchre where the shattered dreadnought frame of Brother Bombastus lay interred. He paused and pressed a gauntlet against the cold metal. He moved on, deeper into the cold heart of the ship. Tarsa's deep green armour bled hot vapour, inuring him to the cold. Yet he shivered as the airlock sealing the last cryovault slid aside. Sub-zero air sighed out like breath. Tarsa chided himself for employing such metaphors, but he was a native of Nocturne, raised in a culture of legends passed down from father to son around the hearth fire. Tales of war, tales of Heldrakes, and tales of the undying fire souls beneath the world. Such ingrained habits were hard to break. Ulrak Branthan's vault was a tomb in all but name, an icy cave of airless chill and hissing, wheezing machinery. Thermal tarpaulins covered the most sensitive mechanisms, and insulated cables pulsed on the deck plates like dormant serpents. At the centre of the chamber sat the glass-topped casket, in which lay the mortally wounded captain of the Sisypheum. Its surface was all but obscured by layers of blue-white frost that scattered winking reflections in the half-light. As had become his habit of late, Tarsa reached out to touch the glass, wiping away the frost over Ulrak Branthan's recumbent form. Familiarity had not dulled Tarsa to the honour of the man's wounds. Missing limbs, fist-deep craters torn by mass reactives, dreadful canyons of chainblade impacts and hideous phosphex burns. Enough to kill a man thrice over. Yet Branthan endured. In most other legions, such wounds would have seen him allowed to die, or be interred within a dreadnought. But the time Tarsa had spent aboard the Sisypheum had taught him that the Iron Hands were not most other legions. The Heart of Iron still squatted on his chest like a parasite, a vaguely arachnoid machine of brass and silver that was simultaneously healing and consuming Branthan. Thread-fine tendrils extruded from its segmented body to penetrate Branthan's flesh. Where they were going or what they were doing within his body was a mystery. None of Tarsa's equipment could map the paths they took. In the brief moments where they risked rousing Branthan to seek his counsel, it appeared the Archaeotech device was remaking his catastrophically damaged organs, but only at the cost of the captain's, for want of a better term, life force. Tarsa leaned close to the casket, the coal dark skin and red eyes of his proud Nocturnian heritage reflected in the frosted glass.
"You cling to life with a determination that goes beyond all reason," he said, his voice little more than a whisper. "These sons of Vulcan are proud and courageous, but we know when to advance and when to retreat. It is time to let go, Ulrak."
Cadmus Tyro would kill him for such words.
The acting captain of the Sisypheum believed Branthon could be made whole again, but Tarsus's efforts were only prolonging Branthon's suffering. Decades spent training in the Apothecarium told him Branthon could not possibly hear his words within a stasis field, but the part of his soul that wanted to believe in miracles wished he could. He turned from the casket and took a deep breath, his eyes widening as blast-chilled air filled his lungs. So different from the volcanic homeworld he never expected to see again. Turning from Branthon's casket, Tarsa busied himself with the safe interment of the progenoids he had extracted from the fallen warriors. Each loss was a grievous blow to the Sisypheum. They had not the numbers to suffer such losses easily. Years spent fighting on the ragged edges of this war had taken its toll on the already diminished crew of the strike cruiser. The expedition into the Warp Tempest in pursuit of the Phoenician and the Lord of Iron had cost them dearly, as had their escape. With a mere 42 warriors and a fast diminishing stock of supplies, the time was approaching when their continued presence in the wilds of space would become unsustainable. Soon, Tarsa knew, someone was going to have to convince Cadmus Tyro it was time to return to the Imperium. He sighed, knowing that duty would fall to him. Sharokin was Ravenguard to the core and relished this form of war. He would never suggest it. And none of the Iron Tenth would shame themselves by admitting they could no longer continue this campaign of guerrilla war.
I have seen the same behavior in Pyrogarials, said Tarsa to the silent casket,
as he sterilized the interior of the reductor and sealed its cylindrical sample chambers.
They're fiercely territorial lava-swimming lizards that dwell in the caldera of Nocturne's volcanoes, he said by way of explanation.
Tarsa stepped over the hissing cables on the deck to sit next to Branthon's casket. He rested a hand on the glass as he continued.
When an earthquake or the lava flow from a fresh eruption brings two lizards into competition for burrows, they will not stop until the fighting is done, and one of them is dead.
He sighed.
From an evolutionary standpoint, it is self-defeating behavior that appears to serve no purpose. Yet still they do it as though it is hardwired into their reptile brains, leaving them incapable of change. I remember climbing into the fires of Mount Kagutsuchi on the eve of my ascension to the Legion, and seeing two such beasts in battle. It was an incredible sight, Ulrich. Two basalt-scaled monsters tearing at each other for the sake of a lava pool barely large enough to hold either one of them. Yet fight for it they did. But as I watched them battle, a great sorrow filled me at such senseless waste. What need had they to fight for this particular pool when there were many others within easy reach? Yet the beasts knew no difference, so what else could they do? In the end, the bloodied victor did not enjoy his spoils for long. A third beast came down from a magma vent higher up the caldera and devoured him. If there is a lesson to be learned, it is the clumsy, wasteful, blundering, low, and horribly cruel works of nature that govern all living things.
Tarsa's head sank to his chest, and he said,
Ah, forgive me, Captain Branthon. Memories of Nocturne are making me melancholy. I miss the russet skies of my birthworld, and the fiery winds that sweep its blackened mountains.
He looked into the shimmering ice coating the casket, and it seemed he saw a reflection of himself. He blinked. The Salamander's legionary in the ice sat before a casket of gold, at the head of which burned a solitary memorial flame. Tarsa stood suddenly, his heart thudding in his chest. He looked around the sepulchre. He was alone.
Just a distorted reflection, he said. That's all it was.
Yet just for an instant, Tarsa thought he'd heard the faint sound of a distant heartbeat.
He put a hand on the ice-covered glass of Branthon's casket. A sudden certainty filled him.
"Vulcan lives," he said.